vast plains of prairies there, covered with these despicable little farms. So they went down and, as it were, bought out the governments. Well, first the Pentagon went down and subverted all of them, along with the CIA, and then these people moved in and they turned these farms and cities into grazing lands for their cattle, and the people were, their land was expropriated, and they were driven into the cities and the slums. And now we hear all over the place how Americans will go down there and give them aid. We'll teach them, we won't give them a fish, we'll teach them how to fish. However, first of all, our corporate giants stole all their land and destroyed their agricultural base. And what we hear up here is that these people don't know how to live if we would just teach them how to fish. Otherwise, they slaughter the cattle, they ship the meat up here and sell it to eat in burger joints. They take the leather, they make shoes, and they ship them here for people to wear. The people in South America in these places go barefoot in poverty and destitution. That's how
they spend
American
all their,
corporations work.
They spend all their time trying to pay off debts incurred in the 70s when,
they live off garbage heaps.
And these corrupt governments made huge loans that now the people have to pay back. But
right.
let me try to get something in the last hour, as well as a few more callers, John.
Okay, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for letting me talk.
Bye. All right.
So, here we have it, the radical fringe, or perhaps the wave of the future here in Santa Cruz and the United States, perhaps the world. 89.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Call in 427-3772. You're listening to Red Top Robert Flory, who is discussing how the corporate economy works here in Santa Cruz and advising you to withdraw from that economy. And you're listening to Bathrobes Pier, Robert Norris. This is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. And again, the call-in line is 427-3772. It is open. I feel a little bit unworthy here, since I have a number of kind of what may be petty issues, but perhaps it's time for a little petty issuing, since we've been taking the more majestic approach. I picked up an article in San Francisco, one of the alternate weeklies, San Francisco Weekly, which is called Totalitarianism, where we have the toe is one word, dash, totalitarianism is another. And it's about a new car impound program that hands too much power to the police in San Francisco, and I suspect here in Santa Cruz as well. It's by George Cothran, and it runs like this. When asked several weeks ago, Kathy Johnson thought nothing of lending the keys of her car to a friend for a trip to the grocery store. Little did the 32-year-old know that her simple act of friendship would ensnare her in a statewide crackdown on unlicensed drivers and eventually lead the police to seize her car and arrest her for prostitution. An extreme case, to be sure, but Johnson's travails explain how the crackdown, which local officials have dubbed STOP, that San Francisco Traffic Offender Program, STOP, has created a seemingly endless trap of fines, fees, and forfeiture of property, a textbook case in the abuse of governmental power. In the 7 months since STOP was launched, the police have impounded several thousand cars in San Francisco. An untold number have been auctioned off by the city after owners have failed to pay their fines. STOP and its cousins up and down the state was born last year when Sacramento lawmakers, goaded by studies showing that unlicensed drivers cause the majority of drunk driving and hit-and-run offenses, amended the California Vehicle Code to allow for on-the-scene seizure of cars belonging to unlicensed operators. I see the phone is ringing here. This is an interesting question here. I know a lot of you listeners don't like cars, but let's hear what this caller has to say.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
This is Rex, calling on behalf of the First World Students Union.
Yes, Rex.
And I just called up to accept Mr. John's apology for categorizing myself as an academic nerd.
I'm glad you do. And again, I think that you should feel free to join us on the airwaves as well, since your point of view, certainly it's a minority point of view in this station, and I think that if you can defend it well, it would certainly make for a informative debate.
Indeed.
Is there a number where you could be reached, where people can call you if they want to inquire further into the organization you represent is?
the First World Students Union.
The First World Students Union.
Right.
Do you have a number that you're giving out, or?
Presently, we're rather underground and clandestine group. We're a network of students and scholars from around the First World, generally interested in environmental and science issues, as well as, of course, that it is influenced by geopolitics and other interests. You know, the First World is often maligned for good reason, but what is lost in the argument is that, you know, most of the progressive steps taken to correct those problems are, you know, done on behalf of the First World by people from the First World, and that shouldn't be ignored. Mm-hmm. And so often in the discussions, people begin to lament and pound away at Western civilization or, you know, Japan or whatever the hegemonial culture in that region, whether it's the Middle East or, you know, Asia or Europe, you know, United States might be. So we tend to address those issues, speaking up for ourselves, especially on the environmental issue, because third world overpopulation poses every bit as much a threat to, you know, the planet's well-being as does, you know, industrial poison and recklessness. And, you know, in the tradition of the Leakeys, the Johansons, the Cousteaus, Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, all, you know, representatives of the First World working on the environmental question, you know, we make these arguments.
Are you generally, what is your reaction to the kinds of points made by Robert and John in the last 15 minutes? Have you been listening to the station?
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap in the philosophy, you know, regarding, you know, issues like they're addressing. I agree with John on most issues, except for when he lays the blame at a given doorstep or something like that. I don't think that's copacetic to our philosophies. So, by and large, you know, we're very empathetic with that, but we do have some differences and just some points we like to, you know, highlight for perspective and clarity. And you know, that's basically where we come from. We, you know, one of our nemesis is, of course, the left wing and, you know, international, you know, globalist philosophies, which, you know, on one hand can be very beneficial, but in practice has generally been rather destructive in the tradition of Tito and Mao and Stalin, Ceausescu, and that kind of thing. So we're generally a pan-nationalist in political orientation, and we see you know, good you know, benefits coming from that type of philosophy.
How many people are in your organization?
Right now we're based up at UC Santa Cruz. We've got 12 American students there, a similar number from Japan and Europe. And we also have a bridgehead established up at Berkeley with about twice that number of all three categories.
Do you have a net address?
We do, and we're presently arranging to go overground with both voicemail, a website, and other kinds of things. This is something that's been you know, forthcoming over the past, you know, several years, and we're about ready to break surface now. But due to security problems and considerations like that, we do have to lay in the grass.
Do you, I don't want to get too controversial here, but to more fully understand the positions you're taking, do you, for example, support the Governor Wilson's recent abolition of affirmative action in the UC system?
We don't support the abolition of affirmative action, but it does need to be promulgated. It should, you know, there's a lot of fence mending as times change. It needs to be, further developed, I would say, not at all abolished. You know, we also supported 187 more as a protest vote than as an implement, because we didn't think it would, you know, come to fruition in its initial drafting. Was more of a protest vote, because there is an obstinance on behalf of, especially the left, who want to ignore all immigration issues, when in fact this is something that is very consequential to the entire planet, and indeed it's not something peculiar to Californians as being West Coast racists. This is something the entire First World is having to address. They're having to redress their borders and their immigration policies. You know, Switzerland, for example, a very traditionally generous nation, is you know, recently shut its borders, and all the elections in Europe, in Spain, Portugal, France, Switzerland, Belgium, Germany, Italy, have more or less centered around the immigration issue because of rising crime and unemployment, which certainly aren't all to blame on immigration, but it does compound the issue. And again, it's not a European thing. And in Asia, Singapore, Japan, Korea, they are also having to redress their immigration policies and borders because of the crush of third world immigrants seeking a better life. As the population bases increase, the resources are quickly eclipsed, not only by corrupt, rampant industrialization and corporate mismanagement, but due to simple things like gathering firewood and India's tigers populations, the panda bear, fisheries issues, forestry issues are very much affected by third world peoples as well. There's this myth that third world peoples, because of their poverty, tread lightly on the world, whereas the minority of the first world people, with their huge and grotesque consumption, are causing all the problems. And in fact, it's a two-edged weapon. And at this point, with the population of the planet going above 5 billion people, it's more and more likely that the only remedy to the problem is going to be coming from the first world. It's a self-correcting process that the Western tradition and the first world is I think rather famous for. While we do have many faults, we're usually the first ones to point that out.
Well, Rex, here's Robert.
Yeah, Rex. Do you know how these people in the third world got so poor in the first place? Have they always been poor, or how did they get poor?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can barely hear you, so you may have to speak up a bit so that the listening audience can hear what you're saying. You're asking how is it that the third world became so poor? Take South Africa, for example, which has an obvious corruption problem up until recently, and they're trying to further that along. They'll show a picture, for example, of some wealthy white South Africans in white tennis clothes, looking very affluent, and they'll show some barefooted Africans that may not even be indigenous to the South, because they're going from all over Africa, pretty much stampeding to the South, away from places like Uganda and Rwanda. And it'll show pictures of being barefooted in tattered clothing and flies on their face, very poverty-stricken, and then they'll suggest that at one time everybody was wealthy, and that now because of the Europeans, the Africans pictured were destitute. In fact, most third world countries, the people have always been barefooted and always been gathering just flies.
Yeah, I walk around barefoot myself.
Really to the age of 30 because of, medical problems and things like that. So how did they get poor? They are, generally no poorer than they ever have been. Again, going back to India and the caste system and into the Middle East, there's, class structures. And in Asia, there certainly have, huge, gigantic peasantry population. In China, for example.
Rex, let me interrupt you for a minute and see what Robert has. He obviously was, I think his question was partially rhetorical. So let's see what his response is to you.
Well, I would say that the reason these people are poor is because all of their resources. You probably can't hear me. See, I'm talking into the mic, and Robert Norris is on the phone. I'm talking into the mic,
so you can't hear me unless I talk into the phone.
Much better.
All right, but everybody out listening to their radio can hear either both the phone line and I'm talking to the phone now.
Okay.
The way people got poor in the third world was that the first world came in and took away all their resources from them. And we definitely see this in South America. The European invaders came and said, okay, you're all our slaves, and you're going to mine gold for us, and we're going to take all your land, et cetera, et cetera. And so no wonder these people are poor. They've had all their land taken away. They've been enslaved, and that's why people are poor. And I also wanted to comment on what you were saying about people seeking for a better way of life. I don't think that people from so-called third world countries, if they still had their original cultures, if their cultures hadn't been ripped apart by invading Westerners, invading first worlders, that their cultures were probably actually much richer and they live much more fulfilling lives than we do today in Western society. I think that the lives that we lead are actually very shallow. They're cluttered up with all these material artifacts. We hardly have any depth of experience, any range of emotion in our culture. We want instant gratification. We want to make the money, buy the product, have the party, and then maybe we'll live to see tomorrow and do the same thing all over again. But there doesn't seem to be any real depth of culture. And in fact, we seem to live in a very fragmented society.
And also, excuse me, I didn't mean to step on you there.
No, go ahead.
All societies are fragmented to some extent. I don't think you could ignore the first worlders like Dianne Fossey and Jane Goodall and Don Johansson and Richard Leakey and Thor Heyerdahl and Senzo Uchida. I mean, there are many people that are very deep, as deep as any third worlder. And we all share that. You know, their worst are as bad as ours, and their best is as good as ours. I think that goes without saying. People are people across the board as individuals.
Well, definitely, yeah, there have been all kinds of people in all different times, but it just seems to me that the way we clutter our lives up with material artifacts and we isolate ourselves from each other by living in boxes and that we call houses and we drive around in other boxes that we call cars, and the way we isolate each other and the way we're very self-centered in our culture, that their products are marketed and we want them for ourselves. They say, I want this for me,
right.
And that's a very selfish thing, and that tends to create distance between people. Instead of saying, well, we can do this for us, people are saying, I want to do this for me. And I think that's largely a product of corporations. Corporations foster individual greed, and our society has become more fragmented in that way. And also that people coming from third world countries to this country, I think that once they get here, like people are crossing over the border of Mexico and they find themselves living in the ghettos of San Francisco or in the ghettos of Los Angeles, they're going to say, well, you know what? This so-called new lifestyle isn't all that great, isn't as great as it turns out to be, you know.
There are elements of truth to that, but it should point out most of the immigrants that come to here and the first world, whether it's Asia or Europe, first thing they want to do is get a car, an apartment, TV, VCR, and all the amenities, and you know that.
Right, and I don't understand why they want that stuff.
And it doesn't surprise me. Skipping back to the South African or South American example of. The Western invasion, conquistadors, and you know, stripping of the culture and the land and all that. That while that's true, it shouldn't be forgotten. I think there's a little myth, you know, circulating there. Montezuma, for example, was a very tyrannical, sacrificed, you know, hundreds and thousands, if not millions, of his people. Cortez went there and you know more or less took Tenochtitlan with 300. You know, guys, 300 sailors, and most of his army was comprised of Indians from the region who had been subjugated by Montezuma. The same with the Incas. You know, they had made enemies with all their outlying tribes and had been subjugating and raiding them and taxing them and taking their women and skinning them alive and all kinds of horror stories. This is, you know,
right. We just do aerial bombing much cleaner.
Pardon?
We do aerial bombing. It's much cleaner.
Yes, and you know, carpet bombing. You know, selectively, we're willing to go to blow up Iraq because of, you know, oil, or supposedly. And meanwhile, the Bosnian Muslims are raped and pillaged by Serbs, and we remain reticent. There's a lot of hypocrisy there. So I agree with you know, five-tenths of what you're saying, but, you know, with all honesty, I'd say that you know, the First World does have a bad reputation. Much of it, you know, is... undeserved because of, you know, so many of us are aware and taking strides like yourself to correct our culture. And
well, yeah, I'm not so much taking strides myself. In as much, the only stride that I'm really taking myself is I don't want to participate in our culture to a large extent. So I want to try and minimize my participation in Western culture, and at the same time, or actually instead, what needs to be done is to create a new way of living. And it's true, there have been totalitarian regimes throughout history, and it's nothing new that the United States is a totalitarian regime, or that the corporate world acts like a totalitarian regime in the way it exploits resources and exploits its labor. But I think that what we need to do is not so much as decry what the corporate structure or decry totalitarianism, but just to go forward on our own and try to create a better way from the ground up.
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And then good luck in your endeavors. Just, you know, try not to trash the ambient culture while you're at it, because you know, there's many beneficial aspects to this. And if it wasn't for that Western tradition of Socratic open debate, I don't think, you know, we'd have the you know, the society now that even accepts arguments. Again, if you look around, you know, the globe, many other, you know, cultures are much less tolerant of differing ideas and cultures, etc.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Rex.
Carry on.
That was Rex calling in again.
Yes, that was Rex calling in again, and you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, where individuals as diverse as John Stewart, Red Top Robert Flory, and Rex can get together and exchange views. Sometimes they have to interrupt each other to do it, but it's happening, and it should be happening, and we hope it continues to happen. And if you want it to happen in the next 20 minutes with you, you should call in to 427-3772. I'm going to pick up from where I left off reading from Totalitarianism, a story in the August 9th San Francisco Weekly about abuses of the confiscation of car law, which passed last year. So, continuing, STOP, that is to say, San Francisco Traffic Offender Program and its cousins up and down the state, was born last year when Sacramento lawmakers, goaded by studies showing that unlicensed drivers cause the majority of drunk driving and hit-and-run offenses, amended the California Vehicle Code to allow for the on-the-scene seizure of cars belonging to unlicensed operators. When SFPD officers stopped Johnson's friend in July and learned he had no license, they used their new seizure powers. Even though Johnson had a license, she was still liable for the fines. In a matter of days, the cost of recovery soared past $300, far outstripping her meager resources. Previous to the change in state law, police could only issue a citation for driving without a license. Sources say Johnson, not her real name, has told them she went to Cap Street, a seedy hookers scene, to raise the money to retrieve her car and principal residence. Apparently, she lived in her car. Johnson pleaded not guilty to the prostitution charge at her arraignment, but she is currently negotiating a plea bargain with prosecutors. Johnson's alleged decision to hook in order to pay off the fines and fees attached to STOP is indeed unique, but her desperation is not. The cost of retrieving a vehicle impounded under the new program, STOP triggers six different levels of fines and fees, is simply staggering. First, the Department of Motor Vehicles demands a fee to register a vehicle, a necessary precursor to getting a license. Sometimes the municipal court extracts its pound of flesh, too, requiring the tickets be paid off before a license is issued. That is currently the case in Santa Cruz County. At this point, the cost can easily exceed $1,000. Next, there's the tow fee and the daily storage fees. These two combined can easily exceed $500. But that's not all. The police charge a $150 administrative fee to cover the cost of running the program. And if the district attorney decides to prosecute for misdemeanor vehicle code violations, the city can impose criminal penalties which range from $300 to $2,700. Deputy PD, that's public defender, Whitney Lai, who's defending Johnson against the prostitution charge, says another client of his was forced last week to cough up a total of $5,000 to get his car back. Though the success of the program depends on people with deep pockets and high-limit credit cards, not everyone has a cool thousand or two or three lying around. For those people, the effect of STOP is elementary. They lose their cars forever. Under STOP, the city can auction off a vehicle to pay for storage fees after 30 days, according to Lay. In some cases, he says, the city has used its discretion to auction a car off sooner, which gets at a key fault in the program. The punishment under STOP far outweighs the gravity of the crime, so much so that public outrage may become hard to manage once the word of the new law becomes more widespread. Moreover, as with too many laws, STOP has had an uneven impact across class and race lines. In short, poor people, especially minorities, bear the brunt of STOP. All these people are really poor, says Deputy Public Defender Allison Bernstein, and everybody in the system knows that. Speaking anecdotally, public defenders say most STOP cases involve poor people who fail to register their cars because they can't afford to pay off their tickets or simply can't muster the DMV registration fee. Because enforcement of traffic laws is so rapacious in San Francisco and Santa Cruz, the Department of Parking and Traffic uses parking citations as a taxing vehicle, much as a tool to encourage lawful parking. The burden of traffic tickets is particularly onerous. STOP also creates an added bonus for cops. The expanded powers created by STOP allow officers to subvert civil rights in searching people in their vehicles. When a car is impounded and towed, a police officer is allowed to search the driver and passengers and the car itself. Since STOP allows automatic tows, it naturally triggers warrantless searches where even probable cause is no longer necessary. Cops are using this to roust poor men of color in certain neighborhoods, Bernstein says. Increasingly, she says, officers are using specious pretexts to stop minorities in the hopes that the driver will be unlicensed and subject to search. Bernstein adds that she's seeing a sudden interest by police officers in stopping minorities who fail to use their turn signals, play rap music too loud, or fail to install the tiny light bulbs that illuminate their license plates. Since police have discovered their new search and seizure powers, Lies says, they've been flooding the court with stop cases. It's an epidemic. 10% of the cases in municipal court these days in San Francisco are stop cases, Lays says. You see about 8 every day in each court. He and other public defenders say even judges have taken notice and are beginning to grumble. Still, the program is popular among city officials, and it's not hard to understand why. In just 7 months, the police have collected close to $500,000 from a $150 administrative fee that they impose. And that's not counting the other 5 levels of fines and fees, meaning stop has meant, most likely, soaked millions of dollars from those least able to pay. Posed with the program's deficiencies, the assistant DA in charge of enforcing stop falls back on stilted rhetoric. Driving is a right and not a privilege, says Angela Brown, as if reading from a press release. She adds that the most effective way to stop crime is to, quote, remove the instrumentality of the offense. The law was unenforceable before, she says. People didn't get the message. They would pay their citations and never take care of getting their cars registered and getting themselves licensed. Now when we take away their cars, it's amazing how quickly people find the money they need to obey the law. That's some people. I know some people who just don't have their cars anymore. She also cites social benefits created by the program, arguing that it's an effective tool in getting reckless drivers who operate pollution-spewing jalopies off the road. The public defenders say Brown, who is African-American, doesn't have her heart behind her job. Privately, they say she has acknowledged the unintended effects the law is having on civil rights and its disproportionate impact on the poor and minorities. I couldn't ask for a better person to prosecute these cases, Lies says. She is a wonderful person. This seems like a punitive assignment for her. But when asked about these issues on the record, Brown's stern prosecutorial mask goes up. Those are not points of concern for me, she says curtly. And again, you've been listening to this article from the San Francisco Weekly, Totalitarianism. You've got to tally up those toes, in other words. The new car impound program, that is the case both in San Francisco and here in Santa Cruz. And if you've had your car impounded, or a friend has had her car impounded, or you want to say something about this issue, give me a call here in the last 10 minutes of Bath Robespierre's Broadsides. The number is 427-3772. And you are listening to 89.3 FM. And now I was going to give us a musical break, but we have a phone break.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Guess who it is?
Oh, dear. Lighthouse Linda again. This is call number 4?
Probably.
Mm-hmm. What's up?
I was listening to your description, it's not just Santa Cruz and San Francisco. This is a statewide law. The DMV can get around the police who pull you over, other rights you have by impounding your car if they find anything wrong with it. It could be as minor as a cracked rear view mirror. And you can go to the auction and buy your own car back, by the way, in some cities. I mean, those of you with money. But I'd like to also point out that what you read indicates that your accumulating parking tickets can be the trigger that give them the authority to take your car. At about the same time that the law you're describing went into effect, DMV divested itself of this parking ticket mania. So you have to supposedly deal with those in the jurisdiction that gave them to you. But that's not going to stop this raiding of people's cars and anything, including their bodies that they might have in them, on the streets.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that at the same time that this new law went into effect, plus the smoke a joint, lose your license law went into effect. You don't have to smoke a joint in a car, you can smoke a joint anywhere and lose your license. There was another law that went into effect, which was in essence the privatization of the parking fine system. So now, where you used to have the right to go to court to appeal, demand a hearing, now you have to first post a huge bail in order to do this, and there's a whole now administrative, almost privatized system.
It is privatized in our cities.
For paying parking fines, yeah.
I can tell you about mine. They think I owe them $3,000, and some of those tickets have already been worked out in the legal system before they got referred over to the city of Santa Cruz. You know, these cities all have little braces, what do they call them, to put on your car so you can't drive away if they know you have more than 5 or 3 or whatever they decide tickets. and you can't pay them off, and you can't offer to work like you could in court to pay them off, and you can't get out of that system if you don't have a growing income. So the last time they called me up from the city of Santa Cruz and said, you promised us $30 a month, you're not giving it to us, so you haven't been able to keep my promise because now my landlord gets all my money.
Uh-huh.
So they have no leverage either, so she threatens, I guess we're going to have to take you to small claims court. And I thought gleefully, far out, at least I could talk in small claims court, you know? They can't get blood out of a turnip or me, but at least, you know, I can negotiate the amount down if they should take it to small claims court. In fact, maybe I should take them to small claims court for harassing me about these tickets, you know? But unfortunately, because I've been sick and homeless and moving too many times, I can't prove that many of them have already been worked off. So.
Oh, I remember your case earlier in February.
Yeah, the Mulligan part.
We were organizing a support demonstration for you because not only are these tickets confiscations and fines abusive because of the reasons that you have enumerated and that the author in this article, Totalitarianism, George Cothrane, has enumerated, but also they provide a real opportunity for local judges to act like assholes. Judges don't need much of an excuse to do that anyway. They already have power. They're usually part of the local power structure. It's true with our local judges, friendly as some of them are personally. Nonetheless, the judge you went to, not really a judge, the referee, John Mulligan, or meat grinder Mulligan, as I call him, was using that opportunity to demand of you that you pay money you did not have, and was threatening to send you to jail, even though that's illegal. You can't do that under an infraction, and you were lucky enough to get an attorney to come into court to help you. Most people come into these courts completely blind, and they get robbed blind by Mulligan and his little meat grinder system. And that's, by the way, I want to put in a pitch. If you are finding yourself going to court for any traffic infractions or even non-traffic infractions like camping, make sure you disqualify referee John Mulligan, who is the man who will be otherwise handling your case. And you do that, it's a very simple procedure. Just go up to the court window any time of the day, bring up your case, and say, I want to have my case put into another court. And they will do that. You have the right to one disqualification.
And I learned not only to disqualify Mulligan, or perhaps any referee, but certainly Mulligan, but also not to plead no contest, like so often in the past it was often thought a simple, okay thing to plead no contest, to get the paperwork over with, get the court appearance over with, and get back to your life. But it can escalate into an obscenity.
Yeah, no contest plea is in essence a guilty plea. So you don't want to do that unless you are willing to throw yourself on the mercy of the court.
Not just is it treated like a guilty plea, but it puts your rights in the laps of this judge or referee. You know, so you need to say you're not guilty under the system as it is now if it's a parking ticket.
Yeah, which is actually very difficult for many people, because if you do, for example, want to disqualify Mulligan, that means you have to go to another hearing, another arraignment hearing in another court. And then if you want to plead not guilty at that hearing, it means you have to go to another trial hearing. So for many people who are working 8 hours or more and are going to school at the same time, this is quite an imposition and creates quite a difficult situation for them, particularly if the citation they got in the first place is bogus for one reason or another, which brings us back to the downtown ordinances, but that's a whole different dialogue.
Well, it also brings us back to something real important to say in this context of the article you read, that if people don't start putting up some resistance to what DMV and these courts have just created, to take anybody's and everybody's car right out from under you, and they can leave you standing on the shoulder if they want to, then we're going to be handicapped a lot more than we are, you know? I mean, as I said earlier, I agree with Robert Flory that we need to begin building and living and acting as if we want the kind of lives we really need, and not being reactionary and going along with every hoop someone throws in front of us, you know? But those of us who have a relationship with the Department of Motor Vehicles must begin to resist. And if you want to do that, I want to help. if this is not the country that your Mr. Rex is talking about, when DMV has that much power, when the highway patrol or your local police officer could take your car away from you because you happen to be the one who decided to pull over instead of the guy behind you, you know?
I agree with you completely, and I encourage people to help fight this, and the way to fight it possibly is to begin organizing against it, and I volunteer those concerned. Give a call to Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We are, of course, concerned with people who don't have cars most of the time, but indeed, some of the people actually live in their cars, so their cars are even more important to them than your average citizen who indeed has to use the car often to get to work. So give a call to 423-HUFF if you want to help fight this issue or are interested in this issue.
If you want
That's
to help
my phone number.
If you want to help determine the quality and direction of the struggle instead of waiting and leaving it up to Mr. Average Joe, who is just worried about getting to work and can take his second car, call HUFF.
I agree. You can hook anyway. Anything else on it? Well, thank you for calling in.
Except come visit me if my parking tickets ever catch up with me and I'm in jail, please.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, boy, this show, it seems to go on forever, but got some good stuff we're talking about. And I don't see the 1 o'clock person showing up. Is there a 1 o'clock person, Robert, due on the scene? That being the case, we will continue forever until we get completely hoarse. And until we could start playing CDs, but I have a couple of tapes of my own that I want to play. But before I do, I'd like to bring up something about FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Amendment, or the Fully Informed Jury Association, depending on who you're talking about. Now, some of my listeners may know about FIJA. FIJA is an organization that started promulgating an amendment, sort of passing around to various state legislatures, trying to put it on the ballot in different states. A relatively simple amendment, which actually is currently, in my opinion, a part of the Constitution and a part of our rights, but which very few people, perhaps more now, but few initially knew about. And that is that there is not only a legislative, a judicial, and an executive branch of government, there is a fourth branch of government that serves to check abuses by the government. And that branch of government is the people and the jury. So it is that the legislature can pass a law, and the executive can enforce it, and the judges can interpret it, but it takes a jury to find somebody guilty under it. And so the jury can look at a ridiculous law, as, for instance, juries in the northern states in the 1850s did with the fugitive slave law, and they can say, forget it. We're not sending someone back into slavery. That's not something we're going to do. We don't care if it is the letter of the law. We think it's wrong. And that's what's called jury nullification. That's been a traditional right of the jury ever since the 17th century, when a jury trying William Penn, who was the same Penn who founded Pennsylvania, or maybe it was his son, I'm not quite sure, one of the two, held a Quaker meeting in England that the authorities thought contravened one of their church establishment laws, which was currently all the rage in England in those days. And they took the case to a jury, and in those days they would lock up the jury in a miserable, cold, dank room with no bathroom and keep them in there until they made a decision. It was a way of punishing the jury if they didn't come out with the decision the judge wanted, because if they came out with the wrong decision, the judge would send them back for more deliberations. Well, this jury kept being sent back there, and I think two people ended up dying. But the jury refused to convict Penn. And from that time on, under English law, and now under American law, it became the right of the jury not to have its verdict challenged in any other place. Unless, of course, there was a case of jury tampering or something like that. That is to say, a case of where someone used some blandishments or threats to influence a jury. But the jury's own decision was its own decision, even if it was completely screwy to the judge, or even if they said, we don't like the law. So in our system, for instance, there have been some cases of justice done under the current drug prohibition, where marijuana was criminalized in the 30s and is still criminal, and there is still a massive prohibition against marijuana, even though it had been legal for most of the lifetime of our republic. Where the use of this drug has meant people go to jail for months and months and even years and years, and that's still happening, folks. There's a federal law which makes a possession of any amount of marijuana a crime. I think it's one to 10 years in jail, federal. In any case, it's years in jail for federal possession of any amount of marijuana if they wish to prosecute you under federal law, which is not customarily done, but has been done, and recently. Well, we're discussing FIJA, the fully informed jury, and the importance of realizing that you as a juror, and you as a defendant, and you as a person in the courtroom, you have the right, and the jury has the right, to decide that the prosecution is bogus, that the law is wrong, that something is fishy or phony here, even if the crime being charged actually happened, even if the acts in charge violate the law. So if a person was smoking that joint, the jury can still say not guilty, because they can also decide the law as well as the facts. And if you as a lawyer try to bring this up, except in a very few states where it's still a part of the criminal code, like Maryland is one of them, you can be held in contempt by the judge for reminding the jury of their right to nullify. And for some of us, this right to nullify is very important. For instance, if you are an individual undergoing a guardianship proceeding or a conservatorship proceeding where someone is trying to take away your rights, you have a right to a jury trial. And one juror can decide, no, I don't want this person, however many psychiatrists testify against her, to be deprived of all her civil rights for the next year or for the next decade or however long it's going to be, or at all. Or if you are on a jury and a defendant is charged with violating a trespass statute because she walked into a nuclear facility or under the grounds of a nuclear facility to protest, and what was a nonviolent, peaceful protest, and the prosecutor says, well, we approve her motives and so forth and so on, but she was guilty of trespass. You have to admit that, even if you agree with her. No, you don't have to admit that. You can say, she's not guilty. I don't want her to be punished for this action. What judges, however, attempt to do is they attempt to make it a narrow, algebraic question of, did this person commit these acts? Not, should this person be sent to jail and fined and have their car confiscated and so forth. And there's an article in The Nation magazine, July 10th Nation, by Alexander Coburn, who's a local lefty, local resident. I think he lives in Capitola, or he did anyway. And he writes about the fully informed jury. And I'm going to read you this article. You might find it interesting. I see Robert showing me a tape by Alexander Coburn, and that Coburn is spelled C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N, Cockburn, but I believe that the pronunciation is Coburn. And this talks about the recent activities of FIJA, which is a nationwide organization which has little state organizations all over the place. And FIJA is the Fully Informed Jury Association, and they are trying to make sure that each state legislature passes amendments which make it clear to the juries that they have the right to nullify. Now, there are times when the right to nullify is abused. For instance, civil rights workers in the South who were murdered in the 50s and 60s, juries refused to convict, and that was their form of jury nullification. You had cracker juries, and they said, we don't care what the law is here. Our sense of the justice of it is you know, keep those black boys down. That was their point. And that was an abuse. But in the main, my sense is that it's important for the jury to have this power. And I'm going to read you a little bit about what Alexander Coburn says about it. And I'd like to point out to you right now that Robert's leaving. Red Top Robert. Thank you, Robert. He's going off to the hearing of Skidmark's Bob Duran, which is happening at 1:30 in court. And I encourage anyone who wants to support Bob to go down to the court, look for the name Duran on the court calendar, or look for a bunch of long hairs hanging out in the hallway, and check out his hearing. I may do that actually shortly and wind up the show. But first, this article by Alexander Coburn on the Fully Informed Jury. FIJA, Fully Informed Jury Association's activities, have now earned it the attention of Dan Rather and CBS News, which on the June 19th devoted a segment to a case in which the district attorney in El Cajon, California, had opted to prosecute a man dying of AIDS who grows and consumes marijuana for its medicinal properties. The jurors have been exposed to FIJA literature and acquitted the accused. Judge James Milliken told CBS News that if the FIJA movement prospered, we'd have chaos or anarchy, wouldn't we? As its name implies, all FIJA demands is that juries be informed that their root task is to consult their consciences about the rights and wrongs of the case before them, and that task supersedes all instructions from the judge. The 17th century premise was that behind the juror's conscience was God, who made a moral universe. This year is the 325th anniversary of the day when the jurors in the trial of William Penn refused to convict him of violating England's Conventicle Act, which declared as seditious any religious meeting outside the sanction of the Church of England, despite clear evidence that he had openly preached a Quaker sermon. The judge promptly incarcerated four of these jurors, and they spent 9 weeks in jail, after which their release and exoneration established forever as English and American legal doctrine that it is the right and responsibility of the trial jury to decide both on matters of fact and validity of the law in a specific case before it. These rights are enshrined in the 5th, 6th, and 7th Amendments, along with other rights enumerated or implied by the Constitution. The foregoing paragraph is drawn from the sample proclamation that FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, is petitioning 20 states to adopt, and it is soundly based. These jury rights produce the first legitimate legal system in history vesting powers in the citizens. When Milliken said that upholding these jurors' rights would lead to, quote, anarchy, he was saying that there was no moral order beyond the stipulations of the judge acting on his notions of law and precedent. Of course, the rights of juries have been relentlessly degraded. Instead of fully informed citizens consulting their consciences on the matter of the cases before them, we have judges instructing juries to consider, quote, only the facts and the precedents of law. We have judges like Lance Ito gradually infantilizing jurors and treating them like high school students in an unruly class. Jurors with beliefs or views, socialists, vegetarians, etc., are kept out. FIJA activist Godfrey Lehman denounces the outrageous bigotry in the case of the Scottsboro boys and the judicial murder of the Rosenbergs at the hands of a so assiduously stacked jury that every single Jewish candidate was challenged.